We're getting on with our show for this morning. You heard Peter Salmon yesterday as our Barrett lecturer. You get to hear him today. And yesterday we got to tell him what he could talk about. Today he's going to tell us what he wants to talk about. He's going to do it. His session is three paradigms of radiological risk communications: alerting, reassuring, and guiding. And this is sponsored by the National Center for Environmental Health from the CDC. So we're very privileged to have again, back for a second time to this conference, Dr. Peter Salmon.
Which you are free to ignore if you have other things you'd like to do with it. But those who do actually do the dirty bomb assignment, they'll take a couple of minutes after lunch to debrief what came up, so that we will have met our dirty bomb obligation. Okay. I should alert you to the fact that I do 2- and 3-day seminars on one of these paradigms, and I'm doing now a 3/4-day seminar on all 3 of them. So that means we're not going to finish. I'm going to rush through some stuff. I'm going to dwell on some stuff just so that it doesn't feel like you're getting just a very, very thin overview. The more things I dwell on, the less I'll cover. So we're trying to find some sort of middle ground between trying to cover more very quickly and glibly and trying to delve a little bit into a couple of aspects of risk communication that I hope you'll find interesting. But we're not going to exhaust the territory. One of the implications of that is don't worry that if you ask a question or make a comment, you will keep me from finishing. Since there's no way I'm going to finish anyhow, feel free during the entire day to ask questions, to give examples, give counterexamples. You get extra credit if they're radiation examples. But I'm not gonna be very unhappy if they turn out to be pandemic examples or flu examples instead, or even examples from other aspects of health besides the one that's paying the bills and the one that most of you are preoccupied with, that I also am preoccupied with. So feel free at any point in the course of the day to make comments. It should be clear by now that if you don't make comments, I am perfectly capable of talking between now and 2:30 without pausing for breath. So don't worry that, oh my God, if we don't ask questions, he's going to run down. I promise I won't run down. But there's a wealth of experience in this room. And the more we can turn this into a dialogue, the more interesting for everybody it will be. What else? You have handouts. They're on paper. Those of you who are unfamiliar with that technology, see me during the break and I'll explain how to turn the page and things like that. I'm not going to make extensive use of the handouts. They are there. I will use them occasionally. But they're mostly for you to use afterwards to remind you of what we covered and to fill in the gaps of the things we didn't get to. Those of you who find this stuff interesting and want to go beyond the handouts, you will notice that on the bottoms of most of the handouts is a section called "For More on My Take on This Issue," followed by some URLs that send you to specific pages of my website. My website has humongous quantities of information. My goal in life is to get everything I know on my website so that I can really retire. And I'm not there yet, but I'm getting close, I hope. So if you like what you hear, use the handouts to fill in the blanks, and then use the URLs on the website that the handout sends you to as your entree to all the various materials that are available on the website. If you exhaust the website, send me an email, and I'll answer you, and I'll put the answer on the website, and that's how it continues to complete material. Okay, I think that's all that I need to say by way of introduction. Any questions of a logistical nature? Anybody need to know where the bathrooms are, or the fire exits, anything like that? Okay, let's get started on talking about risk communication. And I think I will start with the number. Those of you who like numbers, enjoy this one. It's the only number I expect to use today. Those of you who don't like numbers, and I know you're mostly communication people, so you don't like numbers much, endure this number, and it's going to be all words from here on in. But this number, I think, captures the very essence of risk communication, and it's worth spending some time on. If you make a long list of hazards, and you rank order them in order of something like expected annual mortality, how many people they kill in a good year. And then you make the same list of hazards and rank order them in order of how upsetting they are to people, the correlation correlation between the two rank orders is approximately 0.2. And those of you who have studied statistics may remember, when you square a correlation coefficient, you get the percentage of variance accounted for. If you square 0.2, you get 0.04, a glorious 4% of the variance. Or, and here it is without numbers, the risks that kill people and the risks that upset people are completely different. If you know a risk is deadly, that tells you almost nothing about whether it's upsetting. If you know a risk is upsetting, that tells you almost nothing about whether it's deadly. This 0.2 correlation is as close as we come in risk communication to a universal. If you replace mortality with morbidity in the calculation, you're not killing people anymore, you're making them sick, and you correlate morbidity with public concern, it comes out 0.2. If you're worried about environmental issues and you correlate environmental impact with public concern, it is once again 0.2. If you don't care about any of that and you're worried about the economy, and it's a good time to be worried about the economy, and you correlate economic damage with public concern, you once again get 0.2. It doesn't matter what your measure of harm is. Whatever your measure of harm, the correlation between how much harm some risk is doing and how upset some public gets about it is this absurdly low 0.2 correlation. And the key intellectual problem in risk communication is, why is the correlation so low? And the key practical problem in risk communication is, how do we get it higher? How do we get people to be more concerned when a risk is serious? And less concern when a risk is trivial. Now, a long time ago, back in the 80s, trying to make sense out of this correlation, I didn't come up with this correlation. This is research going back to the 1950s, when I was not doing research. But trying to make sense out of it in the 80s, I came up with terminology that has become very much my signature terminology, and I'm going to be using it today. I referenced it briefly yesterday, but I need to introduce it to you now in a more detailed way. I need to know which one you like better, the overhead projector or the whiteboard? Overhead? Okay. I will use the whiteboard for things that are very horizontal. If you see me using the whiteboard, the overhead markers on the whiteboard trying to stop me. I have notches in my microphone for the number of whiteboards I have destroyed over the years. I came up with a terminology that sent my children to college, and I hope will send my grandchildren someday to college, and I want to share it with you, and it starts with the word risk. Most of you probably know what risk means to risk assessors, but for those of you who don't, let me define it for you quickly. And don't write this down, because I'm going to give you the definition and then I'm going to trash the definition. But it is, to risk assessors, risk is a multiplication of two things. Magnitude, how bad is it when it happens, times probability, how likely is it to happen. You get your best measure of how bad it is, your best measure of how likely it is. You multiply them by each other, and you come out with something like expected annual mortality. And you know you have a future in risk assessment if you can say expected annual mortality with a smile. They don't just expect it, they look forward to it. Now, sometimes that calculation of magnitude times probability is based on hard data. Automobile fatalities, for example, we can go out on the highway and count the body. But for most of the risks that generate controversy and for most of the risks that health departments have to deal with, the data are often not very hard. If we're worried about an acute risk, if we're worried about something like, let's say, a factory explosion, we are in a branch of magic called fault tree analysis, where we multiply the estimated probabilities of events, most of which have never happened. If, on the other hand, we're worried about chronic risk, if we're worried about people getting cancer from that factory's emissions, then we are in a different branch of magic called toxicology, You don't know what toxicology is? And that's where you collect data about what happens to small numbers of rodents exposed to large quantities of one substance at a time over a short period of time. And you try to draw conclusions about what might hypothetically happen to large numbers of human beings exposed to small quantities of lots of substances at once over a long period of time. Which is to say, we all know what part of their bodies risk assessors pull those numbers out of. I have to tell you, as a social scientist, this is a source of great satisfaction. After decades of working with technical people in a wide range of fields, at last I found a technical field sloppier than psychology. It doesn't always make my clients similarly happy, especially if it's that, if that's their field. But the point is that this measure of magnitude times probability is a very tentative measure. It's a very iffy measure. Nonetheless, what risk assessors mean by risk is the multiplication of magnitude times probability. And as I've suggested to you, that's really the multiplication of their guess at magnitude times their guess at probability. And then because they know they're guessing and they don't want to protect people insufficiently, there is in risk assessment a very standard norm called conservativeness, which says you put your thumb on the scale and overestimate the risk so that you will be confident you're not underestimating the risk. So it becomes the multiplication of their conservative guess at magnitude times their conservative guess at probability. But somewhere underneath the random error, which is the fact that they're guessing, and the systematic error, which is the policy to guess conservatively, somewhere underneath both of those, some concept of magnitude times probability is at the core of what risk assessors mean by risk. The problem is that's not what anybody else means by risk. So we have to redefine terms. Let's take what risk assessors mean by risk, magnitude times probability, and for the rest of the day, we're going to call that hazard. And then let's take what the public means by risk, all the things that normal people consider part of the risk and risk assessors define out of the equation. And we'll take that concept apart in a few minutes. But for the moment, let's think of it as one thing and call it outrage. Which leads to the only math I'm going to burden you with today. I would suggest that properly considered, risk is equal to hazard plus outrage. Now, I do a lot of work with technical people, and technical people hate this formula. They'll look at it and mutter, that's what happens when you let an English major write a formula. So for the techies, there aren't very many techies in the room, but for the techies you work with, I have an alternative formula that they will like much better. I would suggest that risk is a function of hazard and outrage. If you don't know what that means, that's hazard plus outrage in techie code. Now, this is a redefinition that makes a difference, and I want to make sure everybody understands why. The way the problem is usually seen, and remember, the problem is this miserable 0.2 correlation between whether you're going to hurt people and whether you're going to upset people. The way that problem is usually seen is as a problem of public misperception. And so my clients spend a lot of time complaining that the public just doesn't get it. Just doesn't understand. Just doesn't perceive the risk correctly. What this redefinition does is suggest something very different and much more symmetric. What I'm arguing is that the experts, when they look at a risk, focus on the hazard and ignore the outrage. The experts therefore systematically overestimate the risk when the hazard is high and the outrage is low. And the experts systematically underestimate the risk when the hazard is low and the outrage is high, because all they're doing is looking at the hazard. The public makes exactly the opposite mistake. The public focuses on the outrage and ignores the hazard. The public therefore overestimates the risk when the outrage is high and the hazard is low. and the public underestimates the risk when the outrage is low and the hazard is high. What I'm arguing is that this 0.2 correlation I keep going on about, far from being the result of public misperception, is in fact the result of a definitional risk. I'm arguing that 0.2 is the genuine correlation between hazard and outrage. Two nearly independent variables that have in fact only one interesting thing in common. They're both called risk by different groups of people. That's going to be the basis for a lot of what we're going to talk about today, so I want to make sure everybody gets it. Any comments or questions on this definition so far? The essence of what we're saying is as follows. If the hazard is high and the outrage is low, give me an example of a high hazard, low outrage risk. Likely to kill people, not likely to upset people.
Heart disease,
okay.
Car crashes.
Smoking, eating too much, exercising too little. I mean, you know, health department's traditional, you know, preoccupations. These are all high hazard, low outrage risks. If the hazard is high and the outrage is low, the experts are going to take the risk seriously, the public is going to shrug the risk off, and the experts will be tearing their hair out, trying to figure out how to get this stupid public to realize that this is really dangerous. If the hazard is low and the outrage is high, the experts are going to shrug the risk off, the public is going to take the risk seriously, and the experts will still be tearing their hair out, trying to figure out how to get this stupid public to realize that this is no big deal. If the hazard is high and the outrage is also high, the experts will take it seriously because the hazard is high. The public will take it seriously because the outrage is high. It's a coincidence. And as soon as they start talking to each other, they begin to realize that it's a coincidence because it becomes clear that they're not really talking about the same thing at all when they talk about that risk. And finally, when the hazard and the outrage are both low, the experts and the public both shrug it off. It's another coincidence, but you don't usually find out because you don't spend a lot of time talking to each other about a risk if neither of you takes it seriously. Any questions about this? All right, let's make it more complicated. I said a minute ago that the only relationship between hazard and outrage is they're both called risk by different groups of people, right? The experts say risk and they mean hazard. The public says risk and it means outrage. But there's another relationship. Whenever outrage is high, perceived hazard is very likely to be high. When outrage is low, perceived hazard is likely to be low. If you think of this as a correlation matrix, the correlation between hazard and outrage is high. The correlation between correlation between hazard and outrage is low. The correlation between hazard and perceived hazard is also low. But the correlation between outrage and perceived hazard is quite high. Those of you who like numbers, it's around 0.7. Accounting for about half the variance. Well, whenever you have a high correlation, the thing you immediately want to know is what's the direction of the causality? So when we look at this high correlation between outrage and perceived hazard, here's what we're asking. Are people upset because they think something is dangerous? Or do people think something is dangerous because they're upset? Now that's an important question. If they're upset because they think it's dangerous, and you don't think it's dangerous, okay, then you gotta convince them that it's not dangerous. If they think it's dangerous because they're upset and you wanna change the situation, you gotta stop upsetting them. Okay, so if you're trying to manage the system, you wanna know its causal structure. You don't wanna be in the awkward position of trying to influence the cause by manipulating the effect. That's not good engineering, and it's not good risk communication either. So there's been a lot of research on the causal relationship between outrage and hazard perception. Let me test your intuition. Well, you're professional communicators, you're probably going to get it right, but let's see. How many of you think that outrage causes hazard perception? People get upset for whatever reason, and because they're upset, they think something's dangerous. How many of you think hazard perception causes outrage? People think something's dangerous for whatever reason, and because they think something's dangerous, it gets them upset. You're divided about equally. First group is right. The second group is also right, but much less right. This is Lane Wobegon then. In the research, it's a cycle. There are arrows in both directions. Okay? But the arrow from outrage to hazard perception is very strong, very robust. The arrow from hazard perception to outrage is much weaker. For the most part, it is not true, that people are upset because they think something is dangerous. It's much more true that people think something is dangerous because they're upset. The same is so on the other side of the relationship. It is not the case that people are calm because they think something is safe. It is much more the case that people think something is safe because they're calm. Outrage is the engine of hazard perception. Hazard perception is not the engine of outrage. And off in a corner, we have actual hazard, which isn't the engine of anything. Now, nobody should get the impression I'm saying, don't worry about the hazard, manage the outrage, and let the hazard take care of itself. Obviously, health departments have as their primary mission managing hazard. What I'm suggesting is that when a health department manages hazard, it isn't managing hazard perception, which is almost completely independent of hazard. If you want to manage hazard perception, you have to manage outrage. Questions about any of that. So it basically follows there are two tasks in risk management. One task is to manage the hazard. You have a moral and legal obligation to manage the hazard. And the other task is to manage the outrage. When you manage the outrage, you're also managing the hazard perception. When you manage the hazard, you're managing the hazard. Yes?
Are you saying that for the most part we're pretty outraged?
Well, I mean, let me broaden this a little bit. Outrage isn't just anger, although the word sounds like it is. Fear is also part of what I'm talking about when I talk about outrage. There are a variety of sort of emotional triggers of being upset, as think of it as the broadest word, upset about a risk. And then, in those terms, the question you're asking is, am I saying that people are very upset all the time? Do I have your question right? No, people are quite likely to be apathetic. People spend a lot of time thinking everything's copacetic, or at least imagining or convincing themselves that they think everything is copacetic. It's hard to get people upset when they're apathetic. It's hard to get people apathetic again when they're upset. They're both difficult. Now, I would, and maybe this is what you're getting at, there is in my mind, I can't prove it, but there's kind of a law of conservation of outrage. I think, you may be more placid by disposition than I am, or you may be more splenetic, more outrage prone than I am, but you are whoever you are, and I am whoever I am. And, you're probably not any more upset this month than you were 10 years ago, or any less upset. What you do is keep reallocating your quanta of upsetness in various ways. So, if a health department can get people more upset about flu, they're not going to become more upset people. They're going to take it away from other issues. If they're more anxious about flu, maybe they'll be less anxious about gay marriage, which would be fine by me. Or maybe they'll be less anxious about smoking, in which case it's not clear that that's an improvement. You don't know what they're going to take it from. But the odds are that, the research suggests that except in the very short term, if you're about to step into a pothole, you have this sudden flood of fear, you're not reallocating it. You're not suddenly stopping worrying about other things. You just have this new fear, you know, flooding you, you know, as a result of all kinds of hormone reactions and, you know, and all kinds of physiological stuff. You know, but that's very short term. Over the long haul, you have as much outrage to allocate as you have, and it's pretty. It may not be constant between people, but it's constant within people. And you know, trying to get people upset is a competitive sport. So in that sense, I think you're right. But I'm not arguing that people are going around endlessly outraged. People are going around as outraged as they are. And when you try to increase outrage about something or decrease outrage about something, you're not really trying to change what kind of person they are. You're trying to, you know, get less of it or get more of it for a particular issue. Does that help?
Yes.
Other comments? Yes?
You know, there's one link that the Discovery Channel had, like a shark week, and my 12-year-old son just loved watching the sharks attacking people. And it just seemed like this whole thing is all about outrage. My son is asking me, well, when we go to Mexico, can I swim in the water?
Media love outrage. There's no question about it. Media are in the outrage business. So are activists. You know. So are plaintiff attorneys. I mean, there are. You know. So are politicians in many cases. There are a lot of professions that feed on outrage. Not least risk communication professionals. So, it's not like I'm putting that down. Where would I be without outrage? Don't make a common mistake of jumping from the accurate observation that media feed on outrage to the inaccurate assumption that media manufacture outrage. Because they don't. I mean, the media are like vultures. It's not a comparison you want to use talking to a room full of reporters. But, you know, media are like vultures. They feed on outrage. But if you know anything about natural history, you know that vultures eat carrion. Vultures eat dead meat. They don't actually kill anything. So if you have a vulture problem, you have some prior problem, some suicide problem that has attracted the vultures. Am I making sense there? So if you do a good job of reducing outrage, the media will still be vultures, but they will be circling somebody else's carcass instead of yours. You know, they have lots of alternative prey. You know, if they're picking on you, that's a sure sign that you're doing something wrong. Okay? The same is true in the other direction. If you're trying to arouse outrage, you need to attract the media. And again, just as you're competing for the public's outrage, you're competing for the media's appetite for amplifying outrage. They don't manufacture it, but they sure as hell amplify it. So you're trying to say, amplify me instead of somebody else if you're trying to do precaution advocacy. If you're trying to do outrage management, you're saying, don't amplify me, go amplify her. Yes?
Now that I disbelieve your statement that the causal arrow goes from outrage to hazard perception, but could you explain to me how that, I can't figure out how you would design a study to prove that. Both happen at the same time, and you randomize people to outrage groups, and it's going to make it more real.
Okay, how do I do that? Here's a study that I think will help. EPA some years ago did a study that, if you want to look it up, it went under the title the Unfinished Business Study. And what they did is they took all the risks that EPA was assigned to regulate. And they assessed those risks on a variety of metrics. They looked at cancer risk, they looked at non-cancer health risk, they looked at economic risk, and I think those three were the only three. And then they looked at what I'm calling outrage. They looked at public concern. And they threw them all into a regression equation in which the dependent variable was the EPA budget. Okay? So the question, for those of you who don't do research, the research question they were asking is what controls our budget? You know, are we focusing on the serious hazards, or are we focusing on the serious outrages? Okay? They found the very low correlation between hazard and outrage. They all also found that the budget was much more a product of outrage than it was a product of hazard. When you do that in a time series analysis so that you can look at changes in the budget, changes in the level of outrage, changes in the level of hazard and hazard perception, you can actually, you know, be at the moment where the outrage is gets high and very quickly, but
the budget changes.
You know, the budget changes. Okay, so I mean, I think there are ways, that it's hard, but there are ways of teasing them apart. Other comments? Okay, I think the next thing I want to do is to put some flesh on the bones of this concept of outrage. I have, you know, I was pretty explicit about what hazard means, but I haven't been very explicit about what outrage means. So let me try to tell you what outrage means. And this is what outrage means. If you have trouble reading this, it's if you've been trying to follow along in the handouts, we should be up to this page. And you'll notice this page is copyrighted 1991. So outrage components haven't changed much. And, you know, and I haven't found any need to update this list. You'll notice the two columns are labeled safe and risky rather than low outrage and high outrage in order to dramatize my conviction that low outrage is one way of being safe and high outrage is one way of being risky. Obviously, low hazard is a different way of being safe and high hazard is a different way of being risky. So, if a risk is voluntary, natural, familiar, not memorable, and so on, down the safe side of the list, what I'm arguing is that people are not going to be upset about it, even if it kills them. If a risk is coerced, industrial, exotic, memorable, dreaded, and so on, down the risky side of the list, people are going to be upset, even if it's doing very little health harm. Now, you can use a list like this in a variety of ways. You can use it to predict outrage. Okay, so you start asking yourself, you know, is this issue going to be high outrage or low outrage? Is my problem going to be people freaking out or people shrugging it off? You can use a list like this to begin to assess the answer to that question. You can also use a list like this to begin to figure out how to manage the risk. So, you know, so you start asking yourself, which of these outrage components are important in the issue I'm working on and open to change? What can I do with regard to some of the ones that are important to move them in the direction I want to move them? And of course, that direction will depend on what your assessment of the risk is, whether you think it's serious and people aren't taking it seriously enough, or trivial and people are taking it entirely too seriously. This is a game that all sides can play, figuring out how to alter the outrage in order to better match your understanding of the hazard. Someone else, of course, may have a different understanding of the hazard and may be working to alter the outrage in the opposite direction. All of this assumes that you actually want to manage the outrage. Sometimes you calculate the outrage of something you're planning to do, and you decide, for example, that the outrage is so high it's not worth doing it. That this is a bad policy, it's going to get people very upset with the health department, and on balance, you may decide there's not enough gain for your mission to justify the very high level of outrage you're going to have to cope with. So sometimes you use a list like this or more complicated lists to decide not to do something at all. Sometimes you use it to decide how much outrage you're going to face when you do it and to begin to figure out how to manage that outrage. Yes?
Peter, I was kind of mulling this in terms of what we're doing at H1N1. And I'm thinking because we equated it with a seasonal flu, it's milder than a seasonal flu. People are going, oh, flu, yeah, I know about that. So, but then the vaccine, the novel vaccine, so we've got a familiar risk and an exotic cure. Is that kind of a bit of trouble?
Insofar as that's true, it would certainly get you into trouble. I'm not sure whether that's how people are seeing it or not, but if certainly, Familiar is going to keep outrage low, and unfamiliar, exotic, weird is going to make outrage higher. Now, you can make a case that weird also increases hazard. You know, the familiar risks, they probably understand the hazard, and unfamiliar risks, you know, maybe the hazard is also higher. But even if you're convinced that the hazard isn't higher, unfamiliar is going to make the outrage higher. So the worst of both worlds for getting people to get vaccinated would be if swine flu sounds like any other flu, but the swine flu vaccine sounds pretty exotic. I think your analysis is absolutely right. Whether that's in fact how people are seeing it, I'm not sure. But if you had focus group results or survey results that people see the disease as commonplace and the vaccine as strange and new, that would certainly account for people preferring to take on the risk of the disease than the risk of the vaccine.
Do you think our equating it to
seasonal
flu is doing it in that direction?
Yeah. I mean, I don't know whether it's had that effect or not, but it's certainly pushing in that direction. Not to mention the fact that, you know, it makes it harder to explain. I mean, the meme that says, like the seasonal flu, would be all right with me if it were immediately followed with a sentence that said, except in the following four ways. The seasonal flu hits mostly the elderly, and this one hits mostly the young. The seasonal flu, is pretty familiar, and this one is novel. And one of the things novel means is it's likelier to change, and it could become much more virulent, much more serious suddenly. And we're pretty sure the seasonal flu isn't going to do that. Seasons vary, but the flu, is going to be much less likely to turn into 1918 than a pandemic is. It's also different in that nobody has any immunity to it, which of course is not quite true for this one, because the elderly people like me have immunity from pre-57 H1N1. If you were talking about the differences, you could say, you could kind of say it's like the seasonal flu except. But we spent a lot of time saying it's like the seasonal flu full stop. Only in the last week or so have we really come out of the closet and said, it's really hitting very different people. Jody and I have been working on a column complaining that the like the seasonal flu meme was misleading. And I don't know that we'll ever publish that column because the like the seasonal flu meme is disappearing. You guys are beginning to sense that it's misleading and that it's pushing people away from getting vaccinated. And you're now talking about the ways in which it's different, much more than you were a couple of weeks ago. Okay. Now let's try not to hijack the whole conversation on flu.
But then that leads to the next question, which is when we're dealing with the safety issue, and we're saying one of the messages that we're using is that this vaccine is made the same way as seasonal flu vaccine. So then if you're going to make the distinction of it's different, but it's the same, then you're confusing it.
You are. But I would, for reasons that Linda's making clear, I would be happier if I wanted to vaccinate people saying this is a weird flu. It's a pandemic flu. Nobody's got any antibodies to it. We have no experience with it. We don't know whether it'll mutate. It's a pandemic. All kinds of reasons why it's different. Okay? And then say, fortunately, thank God, the same technology we use for manufacturing the seasonal vaccine, we can use against this vaccine. It's going to be a different vaccine for this very weird flu, but it's going to be the same manufacturing process. And I think I can have my cake and eat it too. Now, I don't know, when can you back into that now, having said it's like the seasonal flu until you were blue in the face? I'm not sure. But if we could back up a few months, back up to early May, I would want to stress the differentness of the flu and my gratitude for the sense I have that, thank God, the same manufacturing strategies will still produce a vaccine against this very strange flu. That would meet my need to have as much outrage about the flu as I could get and as little outrage about the vaccine. The problem isn't mostly that people didn't know how to do that. It was mostly, as you, if you think your way back to May, you weren't trying to do that. You were, you thought everybody was going to be, was going to freak out about the flood. And particularly in Europe and Asia, there was such fear of excessive outrage about the pandemic that there was pressure, you recall, on WHO not to call it a pandemic for fear that it would excessively frighten people. And I was there saying, that's not going to be your problem, guys. Your problem is not going to be excessive flu outrage. Your problem is going to be insufficient flu outrage. And I lost. Well, I mean, eventually they declared a pandemic. But we lost a good month, and we set ourselves up in an undesirable place.